the Monday, January 24, 2005 session of the House Education Committee is now called to order. This afternoon, we have, again, some informational hearings and invited testimony, and lead off with Vicki Chamberlain, who will be talking to us about the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, an overview and in specific area. And I noticed, I'm just going to have to tell you, as I give my little spiel about acronyms and the usages thereof, she has provided us with a two-sided sheet of education acronyms. And in no way will that subvert the rule, however, unless, of course, you have the first go-round given us the complete definition and henceforth from that point to use the alphabet soup reference. And then secondly, we would just ask that you secure your cell phones and make sure they're either on a buzz or off so that we do not have that distraction as well. And thank you very much. And at this point, you will recall it's $1 to the Health Education Fund, and we're going to raise those funds one way or the other. Thank you, Vicki, for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair Flores. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Vicki Chamberlain, the Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, TSPC. And when you did your acronym rule last week, I was really worried because acronyms are us. This actually sheet of acronyms is something we give our new commissioners, and it's always a good reminder for those of us who get very comfortable whipping these acronyms around to spell them out ahead of time. But for insurance, I have some money in my pocket. I'd like to start out this afternoon and give you an overview of the commission and then do a report that we were required to do from last session. The commission is a totally independent agency. It is not part of the Oregon Department of Ed. It is one of 12 independent boards in the United States, and it's been independent since 1973 and totally independent from the Department of Education. So it is run by a commission that is appointed by the governor, and then the commission in turn hires me. It became the second highest, the second independent board behind California. It was kind of, they received their independence in 1991. And actually we get calls now and then about people who are trying to structure that way. There are 17 members on the commission who work together very well. We have 8 teachers, 4 of them from elementary and 4 of them from junior and senior highs. We have 4 administrators representing elementary and senior high administration, as well as city schools and either our county school districts or our education school districts, or ESDs. And we have a faculty member or one representative from the private universities and one from the public universities. And then 3 public members, one of whom must be a school board member. And then of my 17 members, at least one of them must be an expert in special education. Other requirements are that they have to be currently employed in the positions they represent. And so if they retire and they do not do subsequent work in that position, then we have to have their position reappointed. The agency is funded 100% from licensure fees. We do not receive any state general fund at all. We are in phase 2 of the Ways and Means process this year, we've learned, and we're looking forward to seeing how that goes. The we have 3 statutory duties. We license educators. We accredit the programs that train them in Oregon, and we discipline educators based on that license. And the educators that we license, teacher in our name, by statutory definition refers to teachers who do instruction, administrators, school counselors, and school psychologists. So the word teacher in our statute would represent any one of those 4, and that's sometimes difficult to remember. It was difficult for me to remember that it didn't exclusively apply to the individuals instructing in the classroom. The commission has a staff of around 20, and I did include as part of your handout a, I hope, did you get an organizational chart on the back of your handout?
Mm-hmm.
Great. The 2003-2005 organizational chart would be our current structure, and then the 2005-2007 is the structure that is proposed in our budget request, and what we've asked for is to permanently fund some limited duration positions that we were given last session. We have a fairly small office with about 20 people. There are 61,700 licensed educators in the state, and that's headcount. All right, that's not licenses. If you count the number of licenses that people have, like an administrative and a teaching license or other license like that, then the number of licenses creeps up over 70,000. There are, I keep track of all educators, but often employed is a better picture for us. But we have about 34,600 licensed educators who are right now employed. As of the fall report in Oregon Public Schools, about 2,000 other educators are employed in private schools, but they don't have any duty to report to us their numbers, so it's a little difficult to stay on track of what that number is. And there is no requirement that they be licensed, so if they are licensed, it's because that school or that district decided that that was important. So, for example, the Archdiocese in Portland thinks it's very important that their educators are licensed. And then of that 34,000, 31,400 are teachers, and just under 2,600 are administrators, 2,592 to be exact are administrators out of that. So the way that breaks down is that 90.5% of the employed educators are teachers. Not quite 7.5% are administrators, and then the remaining about 1.8% are school counselors and school psychologists. And then another interesting statistic is that of all the new licenses that we issue every year, only 40% of those are prepared in Oregon. And that figure has actually remained fairly consistent over the past 4 years. We've had we continue to have in-migration of people in the state, and 60% of the new licenses we issue for school districts every year are prepared out of Oregon in other states' education programs. So let me see. I think that that's fairly pretty much the broad statistic. I like to include workload statistics. Sometimes it's difficult to get an idea about what a tiny agency handles, but we handle over 300,000 documents a year. We're trying to get that down to being electronic. Our email is up nearly 20,000. Our phone calls, over 30,000. We have two people who answer the phones and two people who answer email. And sometimes we do get behind, particularly in the summertime.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question? Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still stuck on 40% of the new licenses are issued to Oregon-prepared educators. So 60% have been educated outside the state. Is that what I'm hearing correctly?
Yes. Chair Flores, Representative Tomei, that's correct. Of our new licenses issued each year, the licensee is indicating that their teacher preparation, that includes administrator, school counselor, et cetera, occurred outside of Oregon.
Does that surprise anybody else but me?
Chair Flores and Representative Tomei, I think it shocked my commission. I think we had, when I came here into this position 2.5 years ago, the practice was to assume we prepared everybody we licensed, and we made decisions based on that until it became very apparent that we needed to do some research, and so I did it. I broke it out over the past 4 years, and actually it has deviated very little. It's either 60-40 out of state, or the shift we saw last year was 57-43, but then it shifted right back 1 year later to 60-40. So I don't know what to make of that.
And if I can follow up, please.
Follow up.
So then you're down 400 licenses either issued or renewed from the previous year. That surprises me, too.
Oh, Chair Flores, Representative Tomei, there have been nearly 2,000 lost jobs in the last 2.5 years in the public schools. Ability to continue to fund educators has been impacted by school funding. The new positions, though, were filled in for the retirements that happened. So for actual positions, the school districts have fewer, but because we had so many retirements in the last 2 years, there was a sort of a way to replace that. We still have nearly, as you can see, 40% of our teachers unemployed who keep their licenses active. We have 61,000 headcount, but not even 35,000 of those are employed in the public schools.
Thank you.
When we talk about 61,700 teachers in Oregon, I just read some information that in the first 5 years we lose 35% of our new teachers. Would those people be in this group and for how long?
Chair Flores, Representative Dallum, well, this would represent, this number, 61,700, represents the number of currently employed educators that were reported by the school districts in their fall report to the Department of Ed. So where that number, the folks who leave the profession in the first 5 years, may be reflected would be... Oh, slow down. Yes, they could be part of that number. So let me correct myself. The 34,000 is employed. The 61,000 is active. This could represent dropouts from a job. It could represent temporary employment. It certainly would represent substitutes. They wouldn't be reported as full-time employment. It would include people who may be considering stopping out, and it would also include our retirees who keep their licenses active, for example, superintendents doing interim positions or otherwise, or even teachers now keep their licenses active because they can substitute on them once they've retired.
Well, so we couldn't look at the 61,700 as a pool from which completely. I mean, it might be a pool, but it's not specifically a pool to draw from.
Chair Flores, Representative Dallum, you're correct. I don't have a way to know. I'm not sure our data is specific enough to say what percentage of those are retired. I certainly could, actually, I might be able to tell you how many substitute licenses we have, but that might be as discerning as... we have 4,113 substitute teacher licenses, which would be part of that 61,000. And we have 360 restricted substitute licenses, so that's about 4,500 of those would be substitutes. But again, I may retire on my basic elementary or other license and keep it active and substitute on it. So it's not a good indicator.
Thank you.
And Vicki, before we go further, I'd like to return to the 40% prepared in Oregon, 60% outside of Oregon. And it's an annual licensing issue. So about what does that 40% figure represent, or what is total new licenses per year?
Chair Flores, part of your attachment is a document that looks like this. It's the data that I'm pulling statistics from. And if you'll look at the top graph, in the fourth column where it says total Oregon prepared teachers, the second to the line, the last line there, 2,425, would be the total number of Oregon prepared last year when we would have our most complete statistics last June. And then if you go to the far right, 6,115 are the total number of new licenses that we gave. And if you look up to, you know, the history there is very consistent, except for in 2001-2002 when we licensed almost 700 more educators than we did last year.
And then the 60% who received their training outside of Oregon, you don't keep statistics on why they would have decided to come to Oregon, I suppose.
Chair Flores, no, we do not. They may be recruited actively by a school district. They may have come here for a family reason. We find that they're the probably primarily anecdotal research that school districts have done. People are coming here not to teach, not for the position, but for other reasons, and then find jobs. And so I think the recruitment influence on that number is small, but I don't know what it is.
Chair.
Representative Roland, and I might interject that as a not a full member of this committee, he has an expressed interest as a retired educator and principal, so we certainly invite him to sit in and participate.
Thank you, Chair. The question that I had, and I guess it's not really a question as much as a statement, that 60%, you as members of your organization have to invest more time because they are not in an approved program. Is that true in the licensure process?
Oh. Chair Flores, Representative Roland.
Roblin.
Thank you.
Nope.
Excuse me.
Check your licenses.
Yeah. He's probably one of those actors.
Yeah, right.
How do you spell that? Actually, that's not exactly accurate. We do require them to verify completion of an approved program in their state. And if they cannot verify completion of an approved program, we give them a restricted license and require them to enroll in an approved program. And what that may mean is they may be starting from scratch, because we do issue licenses to people with no teacher training and give them 3 years to get their pedagogical, meaning their methodology instruction for teaching. But it may mean that I have partially completed a program out of state, and then what our institutions do is they would look at the work, if it were me, for example, and compare it to their program and basically ask me to fill in the gaps, if that makes any sense. But to license them as a full educator coming in from out of state, if they've been through an approved program, their university will verify that they've completed that program under their state's rules. Once they take our content tests and our civil rights tests and our basic skills tests, we'll give them full licensure.
One question.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And let me see what page is it. Oh. Concerning the disciplines, and I saw here 190 cases last year. And could you tell me what kind of problems or disciplines are you giving them?
Yes.
What's the cause of it?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, that was the next part of my overview of the disciplines. So that's a wonderful segue if you'd like me to continue. Well, let me explain, I think, generally the actions and then try to give you an idea of the cases. I don't have a great breakdown of the cases, but I can tell you what I've seen in 2.5 years. We have the opportunity to revoke or suspend, reprimand, or put on probation or any combination of those on a license. And the cases that we get are either reports from patrons or reports from school districts about violations that they believe are violations of either ethical behavior or criminal behavior. And what I see most frequently, I would have to say, is probably substance abuse issues. And it's generally reflected through receiving, I almost got caught here, driving under the influence of intoxicants. I don't remember what the other I is, D-U-I-I. And, or occasionally, but not often, showing up in the workplace under the influence. I would have to say that's probably the top instance of something similar. And then it goes everything from manifestations of anger, possibly, concerns about touching, possibly, accessing pornography from a school computer is another fairly frequent report. Just about every conceivable issue that you can imagine, I think, gets reported. But I would have to say, without a doubt, the most frequent is related to substance abuse or some issue around that.
Mm-hmm. A follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
So do you have actual cases suspended and dismissed, and then they couldn't teach anymore? What is the actual cases of those who were not able to teach again?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, any time an educator violates what we call a mandatory crime, we revoke their license for life. And those crimes are put into the statute, and they are heinous crimes, and they almost all involve some type of murder, top felonies, any type of sexual abuse, any type of criminal sexual behavior. I think every criminal sexual crime is cited in our statutes. So regardless if it happens at the school or with a student, if it happens off work and they're convicted of those crimes, we revoke their license for life. So it's just a matter of being doing that. Other revocations, and we may revoke a license if we believe that they've done something that might not be on that list but is very serious. In those cases, the statute allows them to reapply for their license within a year, but the statute also allows the commission to demand that they prove fitness to teach. And that could be, it most frequently for us is a report from a list of accepted healthcare professionals who will verify to us in their expert opinion this person doesn't stand a threat for any reason to children. It's difficult for people to get their licenses reinstated if they have done anything that causes us concern about their behavior around children.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Chamberlain, in regard to that issue, you receive reports of serious violations, even in the criminal nature, from schools, directly from schools?
Chair Flores, yes, we do. Actually, we have an administrative rule that requires the chief administrative official, almost always a superintendent, to report any belief that any violations that they're aware of. So, and this is actually works out very well. I'm trying to see here if I have. In a moment, I will grab a document I have in my briefcase that has a statistic on it. Oh, here it is. It's actually here on the page. 81%, 81 of our new cases last year, or more than half, came from school district reports, and the other 54 came from patrons. That's that big C there. And it's a mandatory report. So if a superintendent believes that an educator has violated ethical standards or a crime or anything, they are mandatorily required to report to us. We are required by law to investigate every report. There is no screening process in our office. There have been a couple that have come across my desk, and I thought, oh, this seems like an enormous waste of resources, but that's not my call to make. We assign it to an investigator. They do the investigation. We make a recommendation to the commission. I personally make no decisions about discipline. I recommend to the commission whether to suspend or reprimand, and they affirm or deny that. So if an administrator does not report, that's actionable also. So if we discover that they should have and they did not, that would be a self-report for me. I would assign that to an investigator, and I've only had one or two of those in the nearly 3 years I've been here.
Of course, my immediate concern, and I think our concern, should be the most recent reporting of the Singham Kaiser incident, where it was known and continued.
Madam Chair, I don't have a lot of facts about that, except that I can report to you that we did not receive a report on that until right before the arrest. Actually, I think I have that information here. I don't have it here. It's in my briefcase, but I can grab it. But I can tell you that I did read in the paper. We get the articles also that, and I had a reporter from the paper call to ask if there had been a report on this case, and there had not been a report until the arrest. So that means that we did not receive a report from a parent nor the school district. So we can't act until we have some knowledge.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. That was the end of March.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on that point generally. Now, you've gotten a report outside of the system, neither a parent nor administrator. Are you able to start your investigation at that point?
Chair Flores, Representative March, I want to be very clear here. The answer to your question is yes, we may. I want to be clear that the Bolera case was reported by the school district, so I don't want any hints that that didn't happen. That actually sometimes happens. We do get the clipping service on purpose, and we have found a couple of cases. That's why I said there haven't been very many where if it's in the newspaper and it looks, even from the newspaper report, serious, we will instigate an action. The statute says either by report, complaint, or on information that allows us to do an investigation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We've interrupted your flow here.
Madam Chair, that's just perfectly fine. I'm going to move down to teacher shortages. And this is specifically classroom teachers. They remain fairly consistent from year to year, almost always in special education, music, ESL, teaching English as the second language. I'll bust myself on that one. Counseling, math, library, science, and most second languages. I think that special ed is one of the most difficult areas that we have to recruit educators, and it's particularly difficult to find special educators who are willing to move out to rural districts. And this is where education service districts probably fill the biggest need for school districts, because they are able to employ these educators to go into a district one period or two periods and then go into another district for one period or two periods, rather than the district hiring them full time. But we still have shortages.
Chair Flores, may I interject a question?
Yes, in the court.
Many school districts are eliminating teachers in music, library media, and counseling. Do you think this would account for the shortage in those specialty areas?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, I don't have an answer for that, frankly. I don't think so. I think that there has always been a shortage in this area, even when we've had the resources to hire. Those are very unique special areas that require unique special educators, and great musicians, as you know, can make more money being a musician. Special education is a very special calling. So, no, I don't think it's a matter of resources.
Follow up. A few years ago, a number of teachers in the district that the part of the district that I live in, my local school district, actually changed their licenses so they could teach in different subjects because of the elimination of counseling and music positions. And just anecdotally, I thought that was interesting because I'm sure if in a small district like Bethel that occurred with more than one teacher, then probably other districts would see the same instances.
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, I think that a little bit of that is also going to be influenced by the employment contract that the educators have with the district, so that if I have the credential, whether I'm keeping it current or not, and I have the ability to work in a position after my position's been limited, I may have some seniority rights to move into that. So what we are seeing is a mass scramble for educators to produce credentials and experience to be meet the definition of being highly qualified under the No Child Left Behind Act in CLB, but I don't use that acronym very often. So that has added pressure on educators with multiple subjects licenses. Well, actually, related to moving down a little bit farther, one of your questions earlier is we have 18 programs in our state who do prepare teachers, even though it's only 40%. And as you can see from this chart, they are primarily prepared in our public colleges. It's the bottom chart, actually. I thought it would be interesting to figure out who's doing what. But 57.5% of our teachers are prepared in public universities. All of our public institutions are now universities. And then 42.5% are prepared in the private colleges or universities. And that's interesting, actually, that our private institutions are so strong in the state. But sometimes that's helpful to know. And then finally, I think that in terms of teacher quality accountability, and it may be because the commission has been independent, but we are one of the states in the nation that has been testing our teachers the longest for licensure. And I know it causes some concern from people out of state, but almost every single profession in the state in the licensure board I went and looked have independent examinations for their credential. And the reason it's relevant is that these licensure tests should be relevant to the content that we're asking to be taught in school with our students. And so we align those tests against the student content standards being developed by the Oregon Department of Education and then set a cut score accordingly. And we were one of the first states in the nation, along with California, to insist on basic skills testing, which may only be waived with a doctorate. That actually is not always passed, and that's because of that, I think, a very good reason why we should continue to administer it. I think I would make one final note. I'm not going to talk, maybe I will talk a little about partnerships, but as a partial segue into the next piece I was asked to do, we changed our licensure system in 1995 from a license that was based primarily on curriculum and set curriculum in an area to a performance-based license. And then we've been measuring teacher content knowledge through our licensure content tests. And now the preparation programs are focused more on their ability to demonstrate that they can lead students to learning gains, that they can do the assessment, and they can use the data from the assessment to make adjustments, and that they can provide differentiated instruction to every child in the class. And when I was in education training in the late 70s, there just wasn't that focus on the individual student. So I think that's our biggest accountability piece, is we're one of the few states in the nation that demand performance reviews to get out of teacher licensure. And then finally, we are operate with 7 huge partnership groups the teachers and the administrators, the school personnel officers, the school boards association, the universities, the chancellor system also independently of that. And I think it's a very good partnership. They work with us on our rules. They work with us on the policy. We take everything out to them. They're wonderful vetters of the quality of the work that we do, and so I want to be sure that people recognize the role they play with our agency.
Well, until there's another question, and before we move on to your next piece, backing up to your comments in regards to the definition of highly qualified teacher, outside of what No Child Left Behind has defined as a highly qualified teacher, what in our state context do we determine to be a highly qualified teacher?
Chair Flores, until the federal law was passed, we believed our licensure system and how we license them defined them to be highly qualified. Most of our current licensure actually fits quite nicely into the federal definition. But I think like every state in the nation, where we ran into problems is at the grade 7 and 8. And the federal government says that teachers in grade 7 and 8 basically have to demonstrate the same level of content knowledge as high school teachers. High school teachers in Oregon, we have always demanded that they hold an endorsement in the subject, a single endorsement in the subject they teach, and that's probably what's given way to a comment people have said frequently that elementary teachers teach children and high school teachers teach subjects. And I'm not sure that's fair, but I think that, you know, I teach math if I'm in high school. I teach third grade if I'm in elementary school. All of that said, what we did under new licensure is we focused on the levels and grades that teachers were teaching, and we moved away from the old elementary secondary model and said that if you're going to teach at early grades, you need early childhood developmental expertise, and if you're going to teach in elementary, you need separate expertise. And our middle level students, we knew was where we were getting our dropouts. You need adolescent developmental middle level expertise, and then you need high school expertise. So we have four levels of licensure. So I'm telling you that to tell you this. The second thing in new licensure was that we required that all 7th and 8th grade teachers have multiple subjects expertise, which is not how the system was when I was teaching. If I was a PE is not the best example. If I was a math teacher only, I could teach down to grade 5 math. And part of the conundrum we were getting into in our middle schools was that you could have a secondary teacher up with an elementary teacher who had a multiple subjects license up through 8th grade. And the kids were treated completely differently. So as part of our developmental move, we said all teachers had to have multiple subjects and one major area of content to teach at the middle level. And that has left them high and dry because under our state law, they can be assigned in multiple classrooms. Under the federal government's definition, to be highly qualified, they have to have a major, coursework equivalent to a major, or pass a test in each of the subjects they teach from grade 7 through 12.
Bachelor's degree, full state certification, and licensure, subject matter competency in each area that they teach. And is there not some distinguishing feature or attainment progression that in the event they do not have that subject matter competency in the areas that they teach, they can work toward that over a span? Is that correct?
Chair Flores, the federal government allowed the state to set their own standards for experienced teachers who they said were not new to the profession, and we did that. We said that we offset for every year of teaching 3 hours of credit. And so what we say is if they've taught for 3 years, they have to have at least 24 hours of subject matter in the area. If it's 4 years, it's 21, 5 years, 18, 6 years, 15, 7 years, 12. So they purchase 3 hours of credit up to 8 years. We said everybody has to have at least 9 hours in the area they're teaching. Experienced teachers, this rewarded them for their time in the classroom. Almost everybody has anywhere from 12 to 15 hours in each subject. So that's how we've used our, it's the high objective uniform state standard of evaluation, and that's the House standard. So
thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to put two areas of your presentation together. We're talking about qualifications. I ask you about a third of the teachers that leave. Do we have any system that does an exit interview when our teachers leave the profession? Is there any follow-up on why they're gone?
Chair Flores, Representative Dalem, I don't think there's a system. It's not a state system. We don't know that they're necessarily gone, probably for quite some time. A school district would know. And actually, the school district human resource network's becoming fairly sophisticated in this state. And they have an organization, the Oregon School Personnel Association, that may have some interest in following up on this. The things anecdotally that we have received in research reports are multitude, and what it appears to be, some of it's money, but most people know they're not going to get paid well when they go into education. Some of it is their perceived support when they get into the school district. Some of it is teaching isn't what they expected. Some of it is they discover that they don't have the classroom management skills that they were going to need. But I think we can say with confidence that we know from research that if our brand new teachers from 0 to 5 years had a mentor, that our attrition for the newly hired would be much, much less. And they've proven this over and over when they've been able to fund mentorship programs for new teachers. So in districts that have the resources to do that, I think you'll find that their attrition rate is much less. And, of course, for small districts, that's just an almost impossibility, particularly if they're teaching two grades or something like that. So I don't know what the solution is.
Thank you.
Chair Flores, I have a question regarding the master's degree requirement for teachers. Is that commonplace, and is Oregon the only state that has that requirement?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, no, we're not the only state that has that requirement. There are 9 other states that require it. We now require, which is part of my next report, the master's or equivalent. And let me explain that a little. The legislature in the late 1980s required our public institutions to provide teacher education through master's degree programs. And the reason for that is I graduated from Western Oregon in 1980 as an undergraduate with a bachelor's degree to get my teaching license. But to get my education coursework, I had to give up some content coursework. So had I majored only in my content area, I would have acquired more content. So in answer to that, and as part of all of the movement for education reform in the beginning in the late 80s, actually it was Representative Katz at the time who proposed, mandated that our public higher ed deliver teacher preparation through master's degree programs. So when that feature became part of our permanent new licensure, for people it didn't seem unreasonable, because of course we prepared all of our new licensees. I don't think anybody had looked at the data, but the idea being that I would get my content expertise first, and then I would spend my graduate year when I get my master's learning how to teach my content. So the segue over into the new licensure was that you could get an undergrad degree, but to get your permanent long-term licensure, you have to acquire your master's degree, an additional year of graduate education. And the commission still believes that's important, except that instead of saying it's a master's degree, which was a hardship for teachers with a bachelor's degree, they have said or equivalent, meaning that they want them to pick up 50 more hours of content, 15 more hours of pedagogy or methods-related instruction, and it could be English second language, it could be anything similar like that, and 15 hours of elective. It's as flexible as it possibly can be. There's absolutely no structure. It would be just hours, which worked out extremely well for educators who are looking to add highly qualified teacher credential, or who wanted to pick up English second language as a potential endorsement. Requiring that master's degree is a very confined program, and that was actually one of the criticisms we received about new licensure last year when we were asked to go back and look into it by the legislature. So, Madam Chair, is that a good segue into that report?
Let's move to your report. Thank you.
I've given you pieces of this report. As I said, the commission came to the legislature in 1997 to enact the law in 1999, but to move from the coursework-based license to a performance-based license. And the idea being that we had adopted Oregon's Educational Act for the 21st century in 1991. We were demanding standards-based education for students, and we had teachers who had not been through any type of standard-based review, performance-based review, or performance-based instruction. So the transformation of our educator preparation programs was huge. Part of the vision was that I would go through teacher preparation. I would do work samples to demonstrate that I could assess my students and use that data and be able to run a performance-based classroom. I would go out and teach for 6 years, and then I would come back and I would show that I could achieve the next level of performance as an educator, even beyond what we would consider performance for national boards. And this was way ahead of the curve for anybody in the nation. And the demand was that set up such that my initial license would expire at the end of 6 years, period. There was no statutory ability to give life at the end of that 6 years once I got my initial license. The thing I think that happened was life happened and economics happened and real life data happened. And that is that, as I said, 60% of our teachers weren't prepared in performance-based schools, so they didn't have a starting point to do the next point. A fair percentage of that 60% don't come out with master's degrees because they don't have programs that are designed like Oregon. In fact, our universities that are trying to get national accreditation, they're building the model to do that because so few teacher preparation programs are offered at the master's level. And the percentage of new licensees who were employed, who were supposed to get this experience, were just not 100%. So the way the program was designed is that I could only get my next stage license by using my live laboratory classroom. You know, it's not a hypothetical performance model. Well, I brought statistics with me. As of today, we have 12,139 active initial teaching licenses, which is this first license I was telling you about. Only 7,100 of them are employed in the public schools. Well, you know, that pretty much said it all. It's not very worthwhile to, it's not a license that was designed for you to go in and complete the next stage without having taught or and having the ability to demonstrate your ability to teach. So this became pretty evident last session, and the legislature and House Bill 2575 sent us out to do the research and to come back and tell us what we were going to do about it. And so what the commission did is they redesigned the second stage license so that it is optional, not mandatory. However, they kept the most important features of that second stage license connected to the first stage license, and that is the master's degree or the advanced education beyond teaching. And how that works is if I came out and I got my first license based on a master's degree, I have to go back and take at least six semester hours or 9 quarter hours of additional education that causes me to reflect on my teaching in some manner. I think everyone agreed that new teachers need to go back and revisit some of the things that you had when you were trained. And if you do not have your master's degree, then you need to get that or the equivalent 45 hours. We're giving them 10 years to do that, and it's not compressed in 6 years. And again, the equivalent number of hours is elective. As also part of that, we want to move these initial licenses to 5-year licenses instead of 3-year licenses. So we've set up a sophisticated transition plan to give them 10 years. Do I send a question?
You went from mandatory to optional. Stretch the time to 10 years. Do you have any research that shows that we have a better teacher when they've gone through all of this?
And Chair Flores, Representative Dallum, we don't have research per se, and by all this I'm assuming you're meaning the continuing teaching license program.
Mm-hmm.
The model was based on the national boards model of certification.
But the assumption is we just get better with education and experience.
No, excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Dallum. The assumption was that I would have the fundamental pieces of my training and my initial teaching license. I would go out and teach for 5 years, and then I would come back while I'm still teaching with my classroom and show you my university program, that I can lead all of my students to learning games, that I can do the assessment, that I can differentiate instruction, and that I can use the data I acquire from assessment to make adjustments in my teaching. What I would be demonstrating to acquire my continuing teaching license.
Follow-up question?
I'm looking at students more than teachers. Those students that had that teacher for the first 5 years, they didn't have as good a teacher then, or did they? If I'm going to teach 5 years and then finish this program, what happens to those students that have that less than qualified teacher for those 5 years?
Well, Chair Flores, Representative Dallum, I don't know that I would say that. I think everyone would say in any profession, when you walk out of that classroom and get that new credential, you're not as sharp at day zero as you are 5 years later. And that the quality that you acquire through the experience is very difficult to quantify. There's no question in my mind that most fifth-year teachers will be better than a zero-year teacher. I don't think there's any way to change that dynamic. I think the expectation of the license was, though, is that there would be a focused, concentrated effort on realizing the skills that you came into teaching with at the end of 5 years, instead of just sort of letting it go or not doing anything. So, for example, all of our elementary teachers prior to 1999 were not required to do anything additional beyond when they first got their teaching license. And we realized that that wasn't necessarily the best model. So I don't have a good response for you. We do not have research. We have anecdotal research from superintendents when I asked them, are you getting better teachers today than you were 10 years ago? And they said, by far.
Does that include new teachers?
Yes, new teachers. That's what I meant. They said, by far. That's not very scientific. However, it's reassuring that we're on the right track, I think.
Is it possible that part of the reason why we are losing teachers is due to this requirement? Because the demands of a full-time teaching job and family would just make it impossible for them to continue with a higher education?
Chair Flores, Representative Flores, it's possible, but it's, I don't think, likely. let me be clear. I think the way it was designed, I think it had an influence. But that statistic of attrition's been around a long time. I'm one of them. I left in 5 years. I mean, I don't know much more what to say about that. The way it was designed is you had to be doing it while you were working, and I don't think there's any question that the old design was an enormous strain on new educators, and I think it was a huge motivator to look at doing this differently. On the flip side of that, those secondary licenses I was telling you about earlier always required that you go get your master's degree. So when I came out and I started teaching, I was a high school teacher, and in that first 5 years, I spent every single summer back at graduate school trying to acquire my education, and it was not instrumental in having me leave the profession. There were other reasons. So I don't think it's likely. I do think that the design that was put on the table, though, wasn't necessarily well thought out and could have contributed. But I couldn't tell you how much.
Thank you.
You made a couple references to national. Is there a National Teacher Standards and Practices Commission or organization?
Chair Flores, no, there is not. Actually, I probably referred to two national organizations today. One of them is the National Board of Professional Teaching Standards, and that acronym you can't even use. It's not even useful, NBPTS. And it's in a performance-based license. The teacher has to, it's $2,200 to $2,400 to take the test. And you are videotaped in your classroom. You have to pick two students. You have to demonstrate you can lead them to learning gains. And then you have to demonstrate expertise in your content. It is, some states actually pay teachers who acquire this more as incentives. Oregon doesn't have anything like that. We have one school district, Gresham, that encourages our teachers to get it. But we don't have a statewide system that supports that. And I understand there's research out saying that they can prove that if you've reached this level and acquired this credential, that these are better teachers, which was the answer to your question. I have not seen that yet. And I am certain Oregon hasn't yet produced research to show that the continuing teaching license program is producing better teachers, except that it just makes sense if you reflect on your teaching and you go back and focus on it, you're going to improve somewhat. All of that said, we don't have good evidence about that next step and what it demonstrates, and it's received mixed reviews. But and there are people who are motivated, including one of my commissioners, enough to go do this extra hard, extra work. It's almost a year's worth of work to acquire the credential, and it's a lifetime credential. The other national organization that I referred to is, I'm going to have to read this one, the National Council for Accreditation of Teacher Education, which is NCATE, which is a National Standards for Teacher Preparation Board, which is made up of the National School Boards Association, the NEA, all of the National Education Association type like groups. And I think that's like $1 or $2. Almost clean getaway. Sole purpose is to set high standards for teacher preparation institutes. And we have 4 in our state who are NCATE accredited and 3 candidates. And so I'm pretty excited about that.
And the first one you mentioned, I'm sorry, once again.
The National Boards for Professional Teaching Standards, NBPTS.
Thank you. Okay.
Find some quarters.
I say you're winding up your presentation. I'm going to deposit in the.
I might have to make a down payment. Let's see.
We know where you live.
I think that's pretty much the nutshell type of overview to tell you we feel very good about the changes we made in this license. I think it's very accommodating for the working professional right now. We have right now 246 licensees who've gotten the continuing teaching license. 221 of them are employed, which says a lot, I guess. Many of them will say it was a very worthwhile experience. And in defense of the university somewhat, it was still a novice program being rolled out, and they were working out their kinks, I think, as it sort of stalled there. They are retaining their programs because it is optional, and the commission intends to recognize these people with the advanced level of certification, type of certificate and recognition that we think their work deserves, but it's not mandatory.
Final question for Ms. Lynn. Representative Lynn.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any exception in the private institution that could teach without a license in a special subject?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, I think I understand your question. For private schools, K through 12, there is no requirement that they be licensed at all. They may self-impose that requirement, but there's no state requirement.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Our next presentation is in regard to talented and gifted children and those programs, and that would be from Salam Noor from Oregon Department of Education and Andrea Morgan. Would you like to come?
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Salam Noor, Assistant Superintendent, Oregon Department of Education, responsible for curriculum instruction, including the career and technical education programs in our state, which we refer to as professional technical education programs, and the implementation of the No Child Left Behind program that federal program areas. With me is Andrea Morgan, our talented and gifted program specialist, and with your permission, Madam Chair, may we refer to it as TAG from here on in our presentation?
Thank you. You've done your due diligence.
Thank you. Ms. Morgan is also our social studies specialist, and she's also responsible for the statewide coordination of our international baccalaureate program and the advanced placement program. She's one of our talented specialists that wears many hats, and we're delighted to be here in front of you and be able to share some information with you about the TAG program and the department's effort in that area. First, I would like to mention that both Andrea and I are new to TAG. We're not new to the program and what it offers students and the opportunities that are available to students in our schools and districts throughout the state. But we are new to the management of TAG, especially since it just recently moved from the Office of Special Education to the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation that we both work in. We welcome that move. We see it as a very positive move because it allows us to address TAG in a very comprehensive fashion and to incorporate it into all curriculum areas that we manage and administer at the State Department. We also see this as an opportunity to revisit and renew the department's strategy for supporting TAG throughout the state and for a renewed membership with the various TAG communities and partners in the field as well. So we welcome that, and we see it as a new opportunity for providing additional support and resources to this program. Our presentation today, and Madam Chair, members of the committee, would like to invite you to interrupt us and ask questions at any time you wish. Our presentation consists of four parts. We would like to provide you a brief summary of the history of TAG in the Oregon Department of Education, and please note that we may not have the institutional memory, but if we can't answer a question, we'll be happy to research it and get the answer to you. We also will go over the legal mandates and requirements for TAG, talk about the current department efforts to support the program, and we'll be happy to discuss with you current and future needs from our perspective, and welcome, of course, your thoughts and your suggestions and ideas relative to that. I will do the overall summary, the legal requirements, and then Andy will do the more substantive part that deals specifically with the program itself and the things that we do to support it. From as way of background, if you will, TAG was actually mandated or passed as a mandate requiring districts and schools to offer the TAG program, and was passed by the Oregon Legislature in 1989. Of course, it was a requirement for districts. It was actually part of the educational program the districts had to offer prior to that. But I think in 1989, as far as we can tell, it became an actual explicit requirement that districts must develop a talented and gifted program and offer those opportunities for students. The funding for TAG since 1989 relied on a series of Jacob K. Javits Gifted and Talented Students Education Program funds, and these were federal funds. There were not any state funds allocated to support the TAG program. And currently, Oregon does not have any state or federal funds designed specifically to support TAG efforts at the local level. There are some limited funds that are intended to support the administration. Yes, ma'am.
Quickly, and then I will insert, and why is it that we're not receiving any federal funds? Or lack of funds available, if not existent, don't apply. We don't apply for them if they're there.
Chair Flores, I think perhaps it's all the above.
Okay.
And again, I can't really speak to the history of it, but over time, funds became extremely limited at the federal level that supported these types of programs, and they were aimed more specifically at comprehensive educational programs. However, one of the things that we will pursue is funding opportunities at the federal level and even private sector foundation level to support TAG programs in our state. That's one of the commitments that we are willing to make to try and secure funding, not necessarily for the Department of Education, but for districts and schools throughout the state to support their efforts.
Thank you.
The Oregon Department of Education's support, as I mentioned earlier, since 1989 for TAG varied depending on the level of funding allocated for this specific function. From a full-time employment perspective, that ranged from 0.9 at one time since 1977 to 3 FTE devoted specifically for the TAG activities statewide, and that's when we received federal funding, and that level of support was critical because we were administering grants at the Department of Education, and the management of grants typically requires additional full-time employees. From 1993 to the present, we understand that the level of support has been at 0.3 full-time employee at the Department of Education, and that is the current level of funding that we have. The law is clear in terms of requiring districts to identify TAG students and provide the appropriate services and programs for them to accommodate them at the appropriate level and rate necessary for each student that's identified for that program. And there are a number of authorizing statutes requiring districts to do so. The authorizing statutes also direct the State Board of Education through the Department of Education to develop rules that govern the implementation of these requirements at the local level. And the rules state very clearly that any district may submit to the Superintendent of Public Instruction for approval a written plan of instruction for the Talented and Gifted Children program. However, although the statute is clear and the requirements are clearly delineated for schools and districts, the law does not require districts to submit a plan to the Oregon Department of Education. And I understand that's an issue that the committee is concerned with, and it's an issue that we're concerned with, and Andrea will tell you about how we're preparing to address that particular aspect of it. The only time that the law actually requires districts to submit a plan to the Department of Education is if they were pursuing funding that's been allocated at the state level. And we would stretch that further and say from federal sources as well. So if we had received federal funds to support TAG programs and activities throughout the state and districts were applying to access those funds, we would require them to submit an application to us. Otherwise, absent the state funds and absent the federal funds, districts are not obligated to submit anything to the state that says, here's what we're doing for the Talented and Gifted program in our district, and this is how we're serving our students.
Question, Madam Chair?
Next thing is coming.
Thank you so much for your testimony, but I just want to make sure I understand this. So by statute, every district is required to provide special education or TAG programs, but the state is not requiring of the districts that they prove that they're providing these services. Am I understanding you correctly?
Chair Flores, Representative Comey, I think that would be an accurate representation of that particular situation, that they are required to identify students and serve students, but they're not required to submit a plan to the Department of Education that describes how they do that.
If I went to a school in Oregon, because of where I live, I'll make it Spray, Condon, or Mitchell. What would I see in a TAG program?
Chair Flores, Representative Dellum, and I'm also going to invite my colleague Andrea to comment on that since she works with schools and districts directly relevant to their TAG program. I think you will see an effort to identify and provide services to students, but the degree and the type of programs and opportunities that are available to students will vary significantly depending on the size of the district, depending on the resources that they have available for that program. Some large districts actually have TAG coordinators. Smaller districts do not have that function, and that function may be carried out by a curriculum director that ends up wearing a number of hats, and TAG is one of them. So I think there is an attempt on the part of districts to provide those services, but their capacity is very limited because they don't have resources that are specifically devoted to that particular function. And if I may invite you, Andrea, to answer as well.
Sure. I think, Chair Flores and committee, I think that the other part to keep in mind is that many times it is the individual classroom teacher that is responsible for giving the services, because they're, even as Dr. Norris said, that we may have a TAG coordinator in some districts. A lot of times there's not a TAG coordinator or a curriculum director. I mean, some of our smaller districts are getting spread that thin. And so it really becomes the function of the individual classroom teacher who may have 30 students in a classroom now having to differentiate instruction for each of these students.
And before we proceed, may we have you state your name for the record?
Sure. Andrea Morgan. I'm the educational specialist responsible for TAG.
Chair Flores, good question. Ms. Morgan, I have a lot of experience with the TAG program because all three of my children were identified as talented and gifted. And during the original identification process, my two older ones actually were in a pull-out TAG program in elementary school. I also worked at the local middle school implementing their TAG program the last year that they actually had TAG. And then we went to the coordinator position, and I found that to be somewhat successful if the teachers that my children had at the time were willing to put in the time and energy into coordinating an effort specifically geared to their rate and level of learning, which, of course, is what we hear all the time with TAG. I just have a question following up to that. Are there any school districts that are providing talented and gifted services to students at this time in Oregon? And if so, where does their funding come from?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, there are districts that are providing those programs. And some of our bigger districts actually have special set-aside programs. Portland Public Schools has a program for what they consider especially talented. That is, instead of just using the 97th percentile on test scores as one of the qualifications, it's 99th percentile. Beaverton School District also has a separate program. There are a number of others, but again, being new to the program, I don't have all the numbers, and the fact that we don't get plans from districts, we can't require those unless they're applying for the state funds. Some of this is, I'm not real sure. I know some of the big and brighter programs that are there. So there are some, but from what I'm getting, it's kind of anecdotal, there are fewer and fewer as budgets become tighter.
Before you proceed, might I interject a question?
Yes,
I don't know if I'm jumping ahead of you or not, so you can hear my course here. Within the Oregon Department's allocation framework or your structure, you have your 133, let's just say, within your primary office, and I think that is a number that came forward from the interim, but I might be off base, but 130 people, let's say, full-time equivalent. And you have a number designated to serve a constituency of low income or identify and educate of minority students, of special ed students, and the respective numbers of positions dedicated to those areas seem to be significant as opposed to the students in to identify and serve talented and gifted students where we had the 0.3, and I think that's the one that's got some of us a little concerned, to use a very polite term. So why the disparity?
Chair Flores, you raise a really good point, and again, we don't have the institutional memory to tell you why it's been organized in that fashion. I would venture to say that the staff, the number of staff that you've identified across the agency, are identified by specific funding sources and funding streams. For example, in my office, several staff members are funded through a number of federal programs. One is the Carl Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Program. The federal No Child Left Behind program. I have several staff members that work specifically on Title I, Title IIA, which is the teacher quality program, Title IID, which is the educational technology program, Title III, migrant education, Title X, the homeless, etc. And I think we're constrained in terms of how we utilize those funds because the funding source has a great deal of stipulation in terms of how you can and cannot use those funds for both the state and the local education agencies. What we are trying to do, however, and I'm not trying to avoid answering your question, and I do appreciate your concern and the committee's concern relative to this, and I also will speak from personal experience. I have children that have been identified as TAG students, and I talk about how parental involvement is key, actually, to making that happen. But we're thinking creatively and innovatively, if you will, to leverage the resources that we currently have. If one were to think that we can divert some general funds from current activities to the TAG program, that is certainly a possibility. However, that means diminished services in other areas. So we have an obligation to prioritize and to try and leverage as many resources as we possibly can. One way to do that is to, and that's the benefit of having TAG in the curriculum office now rather than the special education's office, is that to make TAG a curriculum and instruction issue, to make it a curriculum and instruction priority. So it's not only Andrea's time that's devoted to that, but every content area specialist is looking at TAG as an instructional strategy as they interact with schools and districts throughout the state, as they offer professional development to their constituent teacher groups, whether it's math or science or even business and management or natural resources. We want to help prepare teachers to identify TAG students, do the screening and the evaluation of students, provide them the tools and the resources to do that, and also help them provide services, serve those students to accommodate their special needs, special interests, and learning abilities. So increasing the FTE on the one hand, I'm jumping ahead here, forgive me. There are a number of strategies that we would suggest that will strengthen the TAG program, not just at the state level, but really at the local level, and that's where the investment needs to actually occur. Increasing the FTE, if you will, Madam Chair, may increase the presence of the Department of Education, but unless you increase the requirements at the local level and require districts to submit a plan to the Department of Education, and unless we create the capacity for supporting TAG programs at the local level through funding and professional development and other opportunities, the increased FTE is not going to make a significant difference, in my view. It's really a matter of will rather than a matter of FTE. We need to create the capacity at the district level and the school level to support TAG programs to provide those opportunities for students. And we can do it through a monitoring process that we will be happy to share with you in a minute that really makes TAG part of the overall accountability system. So in addition to the content specialist addressing TAG as part of the curriculum and the instructional programs they're responsible for, we're also addressing it from an accountability perspective through the continuous improvement planning framework. I'm jumping the gun here and stealing Andy's presentation, but we'll provide you some details on that as well that I hope will allay some of your concerns, and although we do certainly appreciate that you would like to have additional FTE at the department, and we're committing to looking at that and exploring ways to increase our commitment at the Department of Education. But in terms of our will and our desire to see these programs grow and be successful and benefit students, we're 100% committed to that.
Madam Chair.
If I just might comment quickly, Mr. Representative Kamei, and that is, I know that last spring there were discussions about the concern of the 0.3 FTE, and there were some commitments made by Oregon Department of Education at the time. And during the interim, there were also some discussions in this very specific regard as well. So I think what I hear you say is that there will be kind of a funnel that goes along in each of the respective areas, training and curriculum and what have you, that teachers will be better able to serve needs without the specific program in place. Am I on the right track?
Chair Flores, absolutely, you are on the right track. And if I may just allow Andrea to actually address that.
Okay.
One of the things that we wanted to share with you today is what we're doing to address the recommendations that were provided and agreed to last spring. And as you are well aware, there was a series of input sessions with stakeholders throughout the state. The department presented its position on TAG and some of the issues that we're dealing with and the challenges we're facing, and we allowed for a great deal of public input and feedback into the direction that we will take TAG. And I believe that we've accommodated a number of the requests, a number of the agreed-upon principles, if you will, from those input sessions, and Andrea is going to speak to that.
Before we do that, Ms. Morgan, I'm sorry, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Noor, I think our emphasis on that 0.3 FTE is certainly not sufficient, but it would be a start, and that's something I would like to see and endorse also. The other part of that is, I would think if I were a classroom teacher with 30, 32, 34 children, I would be loath to identify more TAG students, because then it's an added responsibility on me to provide those special students services to those students. Can you address that, please?
Absolutely. Chair Flores, Representative Tomei, point well taken. We see that as a good start, and we hope to continue to increase the capacity for TAG at the state level, and we're mainly concerned about building capacity at the local level. So we will be diligent in pursuing federal funds and other funds to help provide resources for the field, and I hope that we are successful in doing that as we compete for those resources. I believe your question actually is very appropriate even for the preceding presentation that you had, from Vicki Chamberlain, relative to teacher attrition. And I don't mean to put it in a different context, but you're absolutely right. Teachers today are having to assume additional responsibilities in their individual classroom. And I think it would be unfair for teachers to actually be doing the identification of their students and to be responsible for all aspects of the program. What we hope to do through professional development and through allocating some of our own resources for professional development and seeking additional resources is to help teachers provide services to TAG students more than just be involved in the identification of those TAG students. And what we mean by that is providing them the tools and the skills to teach TAG student at their rate and at their level. Most districts do not have coordinators that do the identification, and quite often it's done by volunteers in the district, by parent volunteers that have some background and experience in that field. But I think it would be too much to actually ask a teacher to do the identification, the evaluation, and the assessment regarding the student's rate and level, and to begin to prepare the appropriate course or curriculum to offer that student. I'm not sure exactly how that will happen in every place in the state. The larger districts have coordinators. Smaller districts often do not have coordinators. But our main concern is really the instructional aspect of it, is to make sure that teachers are able to teach all students in their classroom at their rate and at their level. So as they're trying to accommodate the ones that need additional help, we want them to be able to accommodate the ones that are excelling and at the advanced level.
Yeah, one question. Do you have any research that indicates that our present cadre of teachers do not know how to identify TAG students? Do you have any research that says our present cadre of teachers need help identifying TAG students?
Chair Flores, Representative Dullum, I believe from my own experience, in fact, teachers typically are able to identify the students that are likely to be a TAG student. However, quite often that student is referred to a TAG coordinator at the district level that engages in a more extensive evaluation of that student, and typically they are allowed to take a number of tests to determine the area that they excel at. So I think that the point of distinction for us here is to not shift that burden on teachers. And I'm not aware of any research that has actually measured whether teachers have the ability to identify a TAG student or not, or whether they need that training. What we know about, what we're aware of, is teachers' ability to teach every student in their classroom. And what we want to equip them with are the skills and the expertise to differentiate their instruction to be able to accommodate every single student in their classroom. Those that need the additional help, those that are in the kind of the average range, and those that excel. And that is a skill that teachers really have to develop, and they have to develop it over time.
Again, the question, do we have any research that says they don't have those skills? That would be my fundamental question, because if our teachers have the skills and can identify the students, then what we're doing is asking them to write a report on what they know. And I suspect they know that. The teachers that I've met are highly qualified, very dedicated. In fact, it's very easy to be their champion. But it looks like I'm giving them a report to write. From here.
Representative Chair Flores?
Well, oh. Representative March.
I just was going to follow up with something Representative Dahlem said.
I'll defer to
my experience with teachers, they are able to identify which students are probably gifted. And generally then will take that list of students that they believe to be gifted and give the names to the appropriate person that then will administer the test, because the test is quite involved. I mean, there used to be three parts, and correct me if I'm wrong, there was a standardized test, then there was an IQ test, which my oldest son took, and then there was a portfolio, which did not require testing, a portfolio of work samples, which by committee would determine if that student qualified as gifted. Sometimes there are students who are highly motivated and really quick at grasping a subject, but they don't really qualify as gifted. And so then it's up to whoever is administering one of those three tests to determine if they meet the criteria. But something that you said that I think is extremely important, teachers are required to do more, and they do need to teach a variety of students, from learning disabled, special ed, to the gifted student. And gifted students quite often will get the shaft, because what they'll get is more work. I remember my son came home and said, you know, I don't really want to be called a TAG kid anymore because I just have more math work, and I don't really like math anyway, so take me off the list. So I think that's extremely important, because they don't want more work, they just need different work.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I, with a non-political reference, the members to your left are not the enemy here. It's the those freshmen who are not to blame in the previous budget years, but it's a very simple problem. We have not provided the money for TAG, and there is no money, state money, provided for TAG. All we're barely paying for a third of a person, and so we're asking the schools to identify students with special, you know, learning abilities, and to teach them well, and not giving them the tools to do it. So I've seen the enemy; they are us.
Thank you for the comment, and I won't debate that.
Sure.
I will just note that during the interim, our effort was to call it, rather than enhance funding streams, to reallocating certain resources, certainly within the Department of Education, with the numbers of people assigned to various areas. So we felt that was probably something that was worthwhile to explore. Representative Roblin.
And along, Chair, along that line, and it's nice to see you, Dr. North. We've done a number of things together over a long period of time. the part that I hope the department is looking at, and I guess I would put here, that goes along with what our chair just said, is that we know that there are this percentage of students who can be identified as PEG, and it ranges from that 3%, you know, the 97th percentile. But if it one's in math and they're not in English, another one is in English, it can be a larger group, say 7 or 8% of people, could in one area or another. And that should be true of every one of our programs, whether it's the migrant workers or whether it's the poverty group or whether it's the whatever group we have. If you look at them, there's a percentage of those students, many times underrepresented in different groups, but who truly are there and are gifted. And each of those programs that come with federal money, couldn't some of that money be set aside? Because I believe it is a distinctly different thing to take and work with kids, whether it's in a student from poverty or a student in a vocational program who is truly a TAG student. That is a truly different thing, and that not having an advocate at the state level to point those things out and to work with those other departments, and having it embedded in each department, it goes away. We lose the effect of it. So I guess what I'm saying is, have we looked at ways in which we take that percentage of money from some of those other programs to put together to fund positions in TAG at the state level?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, I'm delighted to be able to say that. I think you make an excellent suggestion. It's one of the options we're currently considering, looking at the federal funding sources that we receive, even in career and technical education, because you're absolutely right. Students in career and technical education actually often excel in the academic areas in those fields simply because of the high level of sophistication of the content. Engineers, for example. And that's one of the options we're considering currently, to look at the state funds that we receive to see if we have any discretion to pool some resources together to increase the presence at the state level. I have to be honest with you, the constraint that we have is in the actual the full-time equivalent, because Andy took on this responsibility in addition to everything else that she's doing. So one of the things that we want to explore is the possibility of position authority at the department that allows us to pool some of those funds together and have a person and be devoted specifically for TAG, with the understanding that they will work across all curricular areas, the academic content areas, the career and technical areas, which we have 7 of those, and also the federal programs in terms of the Title I, Title II, and III, that you're absolutely correct, have a percentage of students that excel and need to have specialized services directed at them as well. So that's one of the things we're committed to doing, and we started to look at our funding sources to explore some options. There are some, I would say, structural things we're also considering in terms of our relationship, direct relationship with districts as part of the accountability system that we are developing. And I understand that Dr. Burke and others from the department shared some information with you on the accountability. But we feel that's also a vehicle to help us require districts to develop and implement a TAG program. And unless you have additional question, Madam Chair, I'd like to...
Well, once again, I apologize that you can just determine the level of intensity and interest we have here. So please proceed.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we certainly appreciate your passion for the subject. We share it, and we want to do everything that we possibly can to support it, to make it much more meaningful at the local level than it is just meaningful for us, because that's really where we think the difference, what's important is to have that capacity at the local level. I also, if I may add, that we did submit a policy option package to actually secure $6.6 million of grant and aid to districts. Unfortunately, it was not funded, but the intent behind it was to really secure some funds targeting specifically TAG programs at the local level. I just wanted to share that with you because that was one of the commitments that we made to the stakeholder groups that we interacted with last year. I think I will stop here and turn it over to Andrea to talk more specifically about the programmatic elements, and I will certainly take your suggestions into consideration as we pursue some strategies to support TAG in the department. Andrea.
Chair Flores, committee. As far as the activities that we are doing currently, because this is sort of the reality, what are we doing with the resources that we do have? And we have made commitments, and the second and third page of the packet that was distributed has the issue brief that came from the hearing that was conducted last spring. This was done before I assumed responsibility for the program, but it is indeed the very things that I've been working on as a TAG specialist. you'll find that there were recommendations. Working, some of those had to do with the budget. Others were to reestablish the regional planning groups, some other options. And so to begin with these, this has been where we've begun. I've begun my work and trying to get some of these groups and things going again. The regional organization had been fairly strong in the past, but again, supported with grant money from the state. Then when the grant money was no longer available, it was harder to pay to bring these groups together. What I'm finding very inspiring is the fact that these regional groups are indeed trying to continue without any outside funding, sort of a voluntary effort. There was a meeting at Portland Public Schools that had TAG representatives from five counties around Portland that met. Recently, there was another meeting at Western Oregon University where, again, a group of regional TAG coordinators got together to share information and to work together on issues of identification, of resource allocation, how do you help teachers differentiate instruction. And so these regional groups have been very strong as support groups for this project, and I'm trying to do all that I can to support those by attending meetings, bringing what resources I do have and materials. So that has been part of it, to continue these groups, also to take their feedback and see what kinds of things that they need. To continue the hearings, much as we did last spring, we still want to collect more information as we go along with this process. Now that we just took information this spring, okay, we've heard enough, and we're going on. Instead, we really want a continuing dialogue with the groups that are responsible. The second thing we've been working with is with the content specialists in various areas. And for me, it's easy because I am one of those content specialists. But working with the mathematics specialists, the English language arts specialists, the science specialists, and others, as we put together our resources that are in the online program that we have. The Teaching and Learning Workspace is one of the names that we have for it. But it's a web-based resource for teachers where they can go in and search the standards. They can also find activities and things that also work with those standards to teach to the standards. With that, we make sure that there are opportunities for talented and gifted students to help teachers find resources quickly. And so that's one of the things I think that can really increase our ability to work with these students. The other part is working with a resource that was developed by my predecessor. I worked on the project as a subject area specialist, and that's the CD that you received. And that's Challenging High-End Learners. This is a project where we did sort of an integrated lesson creation so that we could show teachers how they can take the regular standards but make it so that it would work with TAG students. Now, the idea is not to create more work for those students, as Representative Farr mentioned. It's to create different work for these students as they address the standards. So how do we have students in a classroom, they may all be studying the same topic or subject, but what do you do to make it so it's challenging for the talented and gifted student, but at the same time, you also can address the needs of the other students in the classroom? And it can be done. As a veteran of 23 years in the classroom, I know that it's possible. We do it fairly easily sometimes for those students that don't have as high ability because we give them more time. We have lots of ways of changing the lessons to fit their needs. What we need to show teachers is how they can do that for high-end learners as well. And again, it's not always creating more work or really, I think, in terms of bulk. It's simply to make it different at a different level of learning or thinking skill. And so that's what this kind of a project, the Challenging High-End Learners, can do. And we want to continue that work because it's written to some standards that have recently changed. I think the idea that teachers can get from this continues, but we want to make sure that it addresses the current standards and that they have lots of examples to let that happen. Another area that we're working with is making sure that talented and gifted education is included in the comprehensive improvement plan for each school and district. And at this time, as I said, and Dr. Norris explained that we don't have a requirement of a plan coming to the state for us to look at and really see what each school and district is doing. It's only if they're applying for those grants are they required to submit a plan to the state. So by including it in the comprehensive improvement plan, we're saying these are the kind of things that you need to show us that we really are addressing the needs of all students and of particular populations. And TAG is being spelled out in the guidance, that that's one of the populations that needs to be addressed in that. So we'll start to get more feedback of exactly what the schools and districts are providing for those who, before this time, hadn't been willing to offer a plan. Again, with me being at a point three of my assignment, it's deceptive because, again, I'm working with those other content specialists. And so in one way, we have more than that working on TAG. I'm the one who gets the phone calls, and I answer parent questions, those kinds of things. But again, we have other specialists that are all also looking into this and working to forward the cause. So I'm providing technical assistance to the field. These regional groups are doing that as well. And we're finding a very strong support from the universities. Those regional groups that have been there usually were collected around one of the state universities. And they continue to provide support for teachers in their area as much as they possibly can. And finally, we intend to seek funding from the federal government if Javits funds are available or if there are other funding sources. But again, that's the kind of thing that gets a little frightening, I guess, if you're the specialist writing the federal grant. It's labor intensive. It takes a lot of time to write a grant, the time that then gets taken away from other kinds of support. And we applied in 2003. We were not funded in 2003 when we applied. So if we are funded or if we aren't, would determine how much we could do with that federal funding. So we have several things that we are attempting to do with the resources that we have. And I think it's a stronger program, again, because it's based in the instruction that we are able to provide the teachers and, of course, in that they can do.
Question? Representative
Lynn
and then Representative Tomei.
Okay. Thank you. While the TAG program is a good program, and maybe 2-3% they are chosen as gifted and talented, at the same time, other 97% they are not gifted and talented in the reverse sense. Some students might have a psychological impact or negative impact, those students who are not chosen. And have you dealt with that program before? Or do you have any problems in the past with the TAG programs?
With the identification. Chair Florence, Representative Bloom. I think there have been students that because they were not identified, they have felt as though they had failed. That there was some kind of impact on them.
Yes.
Other students feel bad if they aren't chosen, others are. I've also seen those students that are identified that will ask not to do that work. They don't want to have the identification even though they are fully qualified for it. I think there's all kinds of things that are differences in the classroom. A number of students when they reach middle school age become for lack of a better term, the underachieving TAG student, that it's not cool to be smart. And so there's all kinds of groups that are affected in this one way or another. I don't think it's just students that aren't identified that feel bad. I think there's a lot of things going on here with the identification process. And again, districts do it in very different ways. Representative Farr was describing the method of identification using three pieces of evidence as a way to do it. Other districts do not have that set a process. And some will only look at standardized testing. Others will look at other things. So again, without having a chance to look at those plans, we're never really sure exactly how students are identified unless the district shares their plan with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kinney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any idea of why the grant was refused in 03?
Chair Flores, Representative Tomei, I really don't know exactly. I know that it's been very difficult to judge why the federal government is funding just about anything anymore. When you submit a proposal, sometimes you think you have the best proposal in the world, and you hope that it will be funded, and it won't. The only thing I have is hearsay, just that our our plan was not one that seemed to meet the vision that the federal government had at that time.
And they don't follow, so they don't give you a response on why they're refusing the grant. They just say you didn't pass.
Chair Flores, Representative Tomei, I didn't write that proposal. Usually you do get some feedback, but again, sometimes that feedback is fairly general and doesn't tell you exactly why you moved in that grant.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions for this panel?
Just one. Thank you. And this is a very easy one. On page one, on your issue brief, recommendation number four, consider a statewide TEG advisory. Is there a word missing there? Or is that an advisory system? Just kind of a statement or what?
Chair Flores, Representative March, I'm glad you asked that question because we wanted to share with you a little bit what we're currently doing to support the TAG community, if you will. There are six regional coalitions or advisories, and that's exactly how they refer to themselves, as regional advisories. One of the things that we want to do is to continue to work with those regional coalitions and advisories, support them in every possible way we can, perhaps look at different sources of funding, as Representative Roblin suggested, to provide them some resources to continue to exist and function in a viable way. So that's exactly what's meant in that set of recommendations. And I also want to note that we have tried to address each one of those recommendations to the extent that we possibly can, and we will continue to do so to make sure that we are supporting the program. The other thing that we're concerned about is professional development, and we're trying to incorporate TAG training and professional development to the general professional development that the office that we're in and the department offers. So it's something that we're very cognizant of. And the other thing that we're also looking into is a way to not necessarily require, but to encourage districts to establish policies, actual policies that they disseminate district-wide relative to the identification and the services that are available for TAG students. And we'll be happy to explore some strategies and ideas with you at your convenience and at your request. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since this is an informational hearing, I see Margaret DeLacy is here as well, and she has involvement in the past with Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. Would you like to offer any comments this afternoon?
Chair Flores, I apologize. I'm here very shortly.
Would you like to come forward, Margaret, and read your name into the record and comment?
I would also like to introduce Deborah Andrews, who's a parent in Portland. She just had an editorial on curriculum development published in the Oregonian, and she has also testified before this committee in the past. The first question concerns...
Margaret, for the record, would you...
For the record, my name is Margaret DeLacy. I'm a member of the Government Relations... Can you hear me now? I'm a member of the Government Relations Committee of the OTAG, the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted, which is a statewide nonprofit advocacy and support group for parents and educators. We're a membership group. And the first question that I would like to address is whether districts are required to have plans. I've been checking this because it was my impression that they were required to have written district plans for TAG services. I would like a chance to research this further before I discuss it with the committee. But I would like to point out that OAR 581022-1310, which has been handed to you, says each school district shall have local district policies and procedures for the identification of talented and gifted students. That's not contingent on a grant. They must have those written policies. And I don't quite understand why the ODE can't ask districts to submit those policies since they're required by law to have them. The second comment I would like to make is that there was a discussion of advisory groups, and we heard that the regional planning groups were taking that function. The regional planning groups are at state universities. They consist primarily of education faculty at those universities. They've done a wonderful job of providing staff development to teachers, but they have no parent representatives on the groups normally. I have sat in on some of the Portland Public School RPG meetings, but I believe that there is a need for a central advisory committee to the Department of Education that would meet regularly and would contain a broader range of representation, including parents and teachers, possibly other community groups such as the PTA or business groups should be involved as well. Final thing that came up, there was a question as to why we were not able to obtain that Javits grant. I believe that only two of those grants were issued. They're very difficult to get. The program has been up and down on a federal level for quite a few years. It has been funded, as far as I know, and will be continuing to offer grants this year. One of the reasons that we were turned down, my understanding is, for that grant, is that the evaluators felt that there was not a sufficient local infrastructure to do a good job of administering that grant. So that it's sort of a chicken and egg. If you have nobody in place, they're not going to pay you to do any more than you're doing. If you have any other questions, oh, and there was a question concerning whether teachers are able to identify TAG students already. The answer is not totally. There has been research on this. The research has found that parents are better at identifying gifted students than teachers in most cases. And teachers have very little training in how to identify gifted students. They often have assumptions like these students will be fine anyway. They don't look for the student who's struggling, who might be gifted and have a learning disability, who might be flunking out of school. They expect these students to be well-behaved, which they frequently aren't when they get frustrated. And in general, without additional training, teachers don't find this an easy thing to do. To decide whether a student is 90th percentile or 97th percentile isn't always straightforward. The teachers want that training. Dr. Pekkanen, the TAG specialist who left about a year and a half ago, has done teacher seminars and handed out surveys to teachers and asked, is this the first time you've heard this information? Would you like to learn more? The teachers are very eager for more information and more training, more resources, and a place to go to for that assistance. I would like Chairman Flores now. May I ask if anybody has any questions?
Thank you.
I have a question regarding the different types of testing. What do you think is the most prominent test? Would it be the standardized TAG test?
Chairman Flores, Representative Farr, the law simply states that a student must be in the top 3% in math, in reading, or in aptitude, or show the potential to be in that top 3%. And it does require one standardized test, nationally standardized test, and one additional piece of information. It's up to a district to decide what the best way is of meeting that standard. They can use standardized tests. However, the standardized tests are not administered to younger children and are not terribly reliable when used in, let's say, first graders. The identification process should be taking place K-12, and we need to identify, for example, students who don't speak English, deaf and blind students, students with learning disabilities, and so on. So the best practice is to use a range of well-standardized identification instruments, depending on the need of the student. There's nothing wrong with using a standardized test where that's available and appropriate, but we believe the district should go a little bit further than that in identifying students.
Follow-up question then?
Follow-up.
If, for example, a student does not test in the 97th percentile on the standardized test, say they test 90 or 88%, then in that case, either an IQ test or a portfolio work sample can amplify the test score to allow them to be identified?
Chairman Flores, Representative Farr, that's kind of a complicated question. There must be one piece of information that represents a standardized test.
So just using a portfolio is inadequate. But there's no reason that some additional testing can't be done. For example, if you have a student you suspect doesn't test well on the state tests, you might go to a different kind of test, an aptitude test, for example. As long as it's nationally...
Oh, an aptitude test, an IQ test? Pardon me for interrupting.
Aptitude tests are IQ-like tests. They're tests that are similar to IQ. They test a student's ability to learn instead of what a student already knows. And they may be used as long as they're nationally standardized, they've been tested on a large number of students, and they're administered by a reputable person. But you can't just include a performance piece like a term paper that is of high quality and qualify a student on those grounds. I might also add that TAG is our minimum expectation. We assume that when we've identified a student as TAG, that they are likely to need additional instruction, an additional level and rate of instruction. But there's absolutely nothing that prevents a teacher or school district from delivering that appropriate instruction to any student. And in whether they are identified as TAG or not, they should be doing that. And in fact, there is a state law that requires that districts assist teachers in doing that. So I don't believe that we treat TAG students as exceptional, except that we need to look a little bit harder to determine what that appropriate level and rate of instruction is for them. All students are entitled to that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you have any comments, Bob?
Yes, I do. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak. I appreciate it today. I also appreciate the excellent questions and the concern this committee has shown for these children that are left behind. That's an acronym that Vicki Chamberlain forgot to mention. My name is Deb Andrews. GCLB, Gifted Child Left Behind. So that's one that should be on your list. She works very hard, and a lot of people are involved with teacher preparation. Sometimes, though, too much time and too much information confuse and blind us, to quote from that book. Focus should move towards student learning. And without the label of gifted, that's really what we're talking about here, allowing all children to learn at school. These children learn more quickly and in a different fashion. We call them gifted. It's their style of learning. The university system in Oregon does not train teachers to teach these children. The TSPC needs to look hard at teacher preparation. When a principal can get up in front of City Club and say that the new teachers in Oregon do not know how to teach children how to read, in her experience, it's a problem. It needs to be addressed. Veteran teachers are concerned about the new teachers in their schools being able to teach children. When a co-chair of the school board in a large district in Oregon says only 2% of the eighth graders entering high school meet benchmarks, it's a problem. People should be concerned. The label, Representative Lynn, I agree, can be a real problem sometimes for children. Why should we need to label them? Let's just teach them, offer them the opportunity. If a child wants to take or needs to take advanced placement classes in the sixth grade or the seventh grade, there aren't going to be other children or parents breaking down the door to get their children in. But that child needs to learn that. He should be offered that opportunity. Let's not look at it so much as special programs, but allowing children to learn new information. They need to be ability grouped. One teacher in that classroom cannot teach 34 children from an IQ of 80 to an IQ of 160. She's not able to do that. Flexible grouping will save money across the board. It will avoid also a lot of special ed designation that does not belong there. Kids are labeled when they're not allowed to learn. Another acronym I would like you to add, Value Added Assessment, VAA. A lot of states are using this. It measures children's growth from year to year. That is the best way to measure teacher preparation and whether or not you have good teachers. There was really good questions about that. How do you know that your teachers are being prepared adequately? If their students exhibit growth year to year, they're a good teacher. They've been prepared well, and they're able to do their job well. I urge you to push for value-added assessment for retention of teachers and training of teachers. Tie those teacher colleges to value-added assessment as well. Right now, they are accountable to no one, and our future, the future of our children, depends on it. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Any questions? Thank you very much, lady.
I just wanted to thank the committee for taking the time to cover this subject, which is very dear to my heart and will make a big difference for our children.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I think you've got your gavel on your hand, and I note that you dealt with this issue in the interim, and I was not a member of that committee, but I would hope that we would revisit this if you are the committee chair in the next interim, if we can follow up on this, that this just doesn't lie here.
Please know, and just for the whole entire committee information, the work that was done in the last interim is being carried forward for our review, our analysis, and our potential action, and I'm hopeful that whatever we are unable to accomplish during this time frame, we will continue to work toward as we go forward. So thank you for that. That would be my goal as well.
Good. Thank you.
Seeing no further business to come before this committee, we are adjourned. We'll see you.